Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 14th of August. We're happy to have Professor Paul Ehrlich with us this hour. He is Bing Professor of Population Studies and Professor of Biology at Stanford University, and he also is the author of Human Natures, written in 2000. The Population Bomb, which was written in 1968, and I'm sure that many of you are familiar with that book because he actually helped ignite the modern environmental movement with that book in 1968. He and his wife, Anne, have a new book, The Dominant Animal, which takes a look at our future on the planet as evidence mounts that the population bomb may have gone off. He has written many other books, is a member of the National Academy of Sciences, and a recipient of numerous international honors, and including the MacArthur Genius Award. In articles about this book, it says that the year may be 2008, but that this scenario sounds like it was taken straight from the pages of his seminal book, The Population Bomb. In short, today's headlines sound an awful lot as though the population bomb that Paul warned us of exactly 40 years ago is now exploding. They look at this growing crisis from its roots in human evolution to the failure of modern governments to respond, a powerful examination of how humans today are creating the world of humans of tomorrow and what it will take for our civilization to survive. We'll be flooded with phone calls, I'm sure, on this topic. And our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you're in Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050. 414-227-2050. To join the conversation. Professor Paul Ehrlich, thank you so much for being with us. Can you hear me? Well, we got a problem here. Hello, Professor Ehrlich? I'm sure that I can hear them, but I'm not sure that they can hear us. Professor Ehrlich, hello? Sounds like somebody's walking across the floor. Here we go. Professor Ehrlich, coming close.
Oh, sorry, it's not him yet.
Oh, it's not.
This is the engineer. He's still not here. That's just somebody else walking down the hall.
Oh, is he in the building, though?
I haven't seen him yet. He's not in the building, no.
Oh, he's not in the building.
Nope.
Oh. Well, okay. I guess we'll just wait.
As soon as he gets here, I'll put him in the chair.
Okay. I guess I'll just check in with you in a little while, huh?
Okay.
All right. Yeah, thanks very much. I thought he was walking into the building. Well, we will try and reach him. I thought for sure he was going to be there. At any rate, let me tell you a little bit more about the book. It's, as I said, the 40th anniversary of the population bomb, and it provides an opportunity to look at his original warning to the world, his legacy, and his continuing work to understand and to explain the crisis that is dominating our planet. In The Population Bomb, written some years ago, he described a rather stark future for the planet with too many people, dwindling resources, massive starvation, and environmental calamity. He wrote that hundreds of millions of people might die from starvation by the mid-70s, and he will answer the question once he is in the studio of how he thinks the book holds up after 40 years. He has some critics, some who say that some of the predictions in the population bomb did not come true, but he responds to that by saying that at this point, nearly every scientist agrees that the Earth's carrying capacity has been exceeded given our lifestyle. The central point of the population bomb has been confirmed by most of the scientists in the world, in the field. The Wall Street Journal might criticize him, he says, but he's received just about every major scientific award there is, and his peers in the scientific community agree with him, and they also agree with the book. Some of the controversial parts of the population bomb had to do with his policy recommendations, which included dramatic population control measures. We'll ask him whether or not he thinks those control measures are still necessary. And he revisits in his new book, The Dominant Animal, a number of the issues that he raised in The Population Bomb. So he'll be talking about what the central message is and what needs to be done at this very moment. He's asked, this is an election year, and if the next president were to wake up the day after the election and call for his advice, what would you tell him? We'll talk to him about that. And also, we'll look at the gloomy nature of the book. Do we have any reason to be hopeful as human beings on this planet that we can change or avert a disaster? And of course, he's eternally optimistic, saying that he wouldn't be writing this book if he didn't have some hope for the future. He wouldn't be running around trying to ignite a response. We need to stop wasting our time and start focusing on these issues. And he's trying to move the political discussion to the survival issues that humanity faces. So we're trying to make contact with him. We have him on a special studio, and we should be trying to reach him soon. We're not sure where he is, but the studio is available for him. The microphones are available for him, and that's all we can do at the moment. So we already have a ton of people on the line. Do you mind if I start taking your phone calls, even though Paul isn't with us yet? I know that many of you have followed this issue for quite some time, and probably many of you read The Population Bomb back in 1968. So why don't we just start taking your phone calls until we find him in the studio? We'll just check right now to see if he's there. Paul, are you there? Not there yet, so let's go to you. Hi, Rick from Marshfield. Thank you for helping me out.
Oh, good morning.
We don't have Paul yet, but we have you.
Well, let me try to string a few threads together here.
Okay.
I think since the Port Huron Conference back in, I think it was 1960, the New Left has devised a whole series of theories and stratagems to essentially wage war on the what they call the bourgeoisie, you know, the American middle class. And I think that this kind of theory and practice espoused by your guests is kind of the tip of the iceberg here. I think that the only women in the world I know of that have actually taken this seriously and either had fewer children or no children at all have been well-off middle-class American white women. But that's not doing anything to reduce the American population. According to the Census Bureau, because of all the illegal immigration we have, we're going to have a population of almost 440 million people about 3 or 4 short decades from now. And the white people will become a minority group in America, but that won't do anything to decrease the population of this grand country.
Do you think it's important that we decrease our population?
No, I don't. I think this is an individual decision to be made by men and women in the marriage relationship, and I don't really think the government has any business telling them whether they should have more kids or fewer kids. But I wish that we could remove these impediments to marriage that have been structurally built into the federal government, like the alternative minimum tax and the marriage penalty and all kinds of other ways of discouraging marriage in America.
Well, I think that one of his major points is that the Earth simply can't sustain a whole lot of people, that it's been doubling at a rapid rate every 50 years or so, and that we're stretching our resources. What will result is that there will be more and more people in poverty. There will be more and more people dying of starvation simply because there are too many people on this Earth. And so it's not just the rich nations, it's all nations that need to look at this so we can continue to survive.
Can I have a follow-up, please?
Well, sure.
Oh, I think that the use of food crops such as corn and other food crops to make gasoline is going to cause mass starvation in the world. I think we're looking at that right now, and I think that's a much more critical detriment to poor people in the world than any growth of population, at least in the short run.
Okay, thanks very much, Rick, for your call. Let's go to Paul from New Berlin next. Hi, Paul.
Hi. Yeah, back in 68, after I became aware of the population issue, I decided not to have children and to try to devote my life to promoting peace and harmony amongst the people. So that one of the problems being, obviously, that all the competition for political power, economic consumers or whatever, that as long as economics and political influence depend on mass numbers, that we're going to have a burgeoning, you know, population on the planet. I was hoping that if you could make some comments. I guess it's up to me since we don't have Paul.
Yeah, right. It's up to you.
Okay, so, well, the comment that I would say that what we need to do is really understand that we're, well, I'm a Christian, and well, I follow a lot of different traditions, actually, and appreciate all the traditions of spirituality that understand that we all are essentially one spirit when we really have a deep awareness of our inherent interdependence on the planet, and that we have to understand that we are really one, working together as a family in order that we can survive. Because if we feel we're in this nature's type of competition for limited resources or political power, we're just going to undo ourselves. And so I'm really putting out a call in my heart, in my prayers, for people to realize that we're just one being, one big ecosphere, biosphere, whatever, and really how we work and function together harmoniously is what we really need on the planet.
You certainly made a momentous decision in your life to not have children, didn't you?
Yeah, I did, because I love children.
Mm-hmm.
And but I figured if I was going to preach, people I try not to preach, but I decided that if I was going to be free to serve others, I would have to be and have this message that I should set the example.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a difficult one, but I decided all that God's creatures were my family, and takes a village to raise a child. That I've looked at other kids as my I've taught school before.
Mm-hmm.
I take an opportunity to talk to children whenever I can to help them understand, maybe find out what they're thinking, and also get them to think about some of their actions and how they impact others.
Mm-hmm.
So it's I gave up a lot of responsibilities, a lot of love, but it's I have a deeper sense of appreciation of others, too.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sorry you didn't have a chance to speak with Professor Ehrlich. He's supposed to call us in about 5 minutes, so stay tuned.
I hope if you have a chance that this issue of the oneness and the many, a deep philosophical problematic for the West.
Mm-hmm.
And that could be discussed and how we can really solve a lot of the issues by coming together as one.
Okay.
Thank you
Paul. Rich is next from Sauk City. Hi, Rich.
Hi. I've, been aware for a long time that, we need to reduce the human population if we're going to survive. I mean, there's limited resources in the world, and, if you keep increasing the demand by increasing the population, you're going to eventually run into problems. And, in the animal world, the population increases beyond its resources. It naturally through disease processes or predation is reduced down to a sustainable level. I think another problem we have with human population is not just the numbers, but the quality of the population that we're putting forth into the future. We have policies and methods that encourage the weaker part of our species to continue on. I mean, we have people in our population now who are totally dependent on medical care for their survival, where if natural selection were to take place, that part of our population would be eliminated and not continue into the gene pool to actually make a weaker species. I think we ought to look at some of them issues too, that we're actually encouraging our species to be non-survivable, that because of certain policies that we have an older population now that naturally probably wouldn't have survived without medical care.
Sure.
Or diabetics, for instance, or other not specific diseases, but there's a lot of diseases that naturally would have been selected out.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of our policies encourage that. I mean, we have no politicians or or governments except for maybe the Chinese and maybe Hitler who even looked at that type of issues, you know, on intelligently managing, you know, where our race as a species is going forward. We have short-term politicians who look at, you know, what the gas price is going to be at the pump this year, you know, instead of our survival as a species.
Are you still
maintain a frontier type mentality that there's unlimited resources and we can just expand out on and on. I mean, that goes through not just the population, but our economic policies, that everything has to expand and get bigger and bigger. Well, eventually, you know, the Earth is only so big, you know, unless we do plan on colonizing other planets, you know, we have to look at, eventually we're going to run into the wall.
So are you suggesting, let me get you right here, that we should think twice about keeping people alive who have serious illnesses?
I'm saying, you know, as far as for the survival of the species, a good disease wouldn't be a bad thing.
A good disease?
You know, if you get on the streets, you know, people get a little cruder in their expressions. You know, there's still racism and all that. And, you know, a lot of people, I still hear it to this day, you know, AIDS was a good thing.
And what do you think?
As far as survival of the species, probably. You know, we have pumped in millions and billions of government money into allowing that people who had contracted that disease to survive on and continue to pass on that gene. That natural selection would have been a certain percentage of them people that naturally would have survived that disease. We would have became a stronger species that disease wouldn't have naturally became a problem because
well, there isn't a gene
would have been resistant to it.
There isn't a gene for AIDS, really. Well, then let me tell you, have you ever been really sick?
Oh, I'm sick right now. I'm terminally ill with cancer.
Do you want to die?
I will. That's just a natural part of life.
But do you want your life to keep going right now?
Right now, at this point, it's getting to the stage of my disease where, you know, the quality of life is pretty poor. So, you know, that's getting close to the point where, the tipping point where I'd probably have to say shortly no.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, we have cancers who, you know, if people naturally would have died at it young before breeding age, they would have... The resistant people would have passed on their genes, and we might not have had such massive numbers of percentage of our population that is, you know, being maintained on medical care where they would have died, and only the resistant people would have survived, and we would have became a more hardy species.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks very much for the call. It's an unusual one. Nathaniel from Milwaukee, hi.
Hi, thank you very much for having me. I'll try to list off the points that explain my overall point reasonably quickly. But in a way, I'd say we might need a new book because I know that I've seen some projections, and Mr. Ehrlich has already seen them, I suspect, as well, and he might be an optimist because of this. That the world population is going to stabilize between 9 and 12 billion, so he knows somewhere the world population is probably going to stop growing, at least for an amount of time. But one of the things that this actually raises concern for me is that a lot of population sizes have stopped growing in the nations where you've got modern economies that consume and pollute to a very large amount. And as the rest of the world sees these economies, they want them as well. And if the world population comes to stabilize, that may mean that the world is actually, as a whole, managed to reach this massive worldwide modern economy. And so you might actually have a stop in the growth of population, but you could still have an incredibly large amount of both consumption and pollution worldwide. And there's actually an economic theory that touches on this a little bit, and that you've got the solo, or I probably pronounced that wrong, model of growth, where if you have a smaller labor force, this actually frees up wealth that you can turn around and invest in the economy in capital terms, which means like factories and other things which directly pollute themselves. So you could actually be trading in people for a more effective method of polluting. And if you look at China, which I occasionally cite, they've actually have a falling birth rate, which means they're still growing in terms of population. They're going to stop, though. And the amount of people that they're growing by year has been smaller and smaller. But the amount of pollution and natural resources that China uses has been growing year by year instead of paralleling the population growth and being smaller on an annual basis.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, we might actually need a book called The Development Bomb rather than The Population Bomb, because you really have, in my mind, the possibility of ecological devastation by fewer people who pollute much more effectively.
Mm-hmm. Interesting points. Thank you, Nathaniel. We are awaiting the arrival of Paul Ehrlich to the program. We don't exactly know where he is, and we were planning on talking about his book, The Dominant Animal. He, of course, wrote The Population Bomb back in 1968, and we hope to do an update of that at some point during the next half hour. I don't know if it's going to happen. But you're filling in. You know the issue, so that's all right. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to your phone calls as we talk about The Dominant Animal, Paul Ehrlich's new book, but we don't have Paul with us, so we're just talking. James from Amory is next. Hi, James.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Pretty nice that we get, seems like we get quite a bit of time on the phone here to discuss the issues today. First, I come with the viewpoint of more of a, I guess, nowadays a radical viewpoint of I would have to flat out reject the evolutionary assumptions that we've been, you know, evolving for millions of years and somehow just now reaching this population of, you know, 6.5-7 billion people. And somehow this population that we're seeing is a big problem. I think people should realize that you could take the whole world's population and physically fit them in 15 miles by 15 mile piece of land, and you'd have the whole Earth left over to provide all the resources for that type. So if you're seeing, you know, if it's crowded where you live, you have to move. As far as the square footage, this Earth was created with plenty of square footage, and it was meant to be inhabited. I think our lifestyle, of course, causes problems, and our greed, and you know, stuff like that. If we truly lived humbly and in harmony, there'd be plenty of stuff for everybody. That's one point I think people should consider. And
so
the second point. No, go on.
What do you think we need to change?
I think we'd be talking to the wind. I don't think the change will happen, but. You know, the basic premise is that I think this Earth was originally made a paradise for us, and we no longer have that paradise. We're trying to build our own paradise is what we're trying to do. We think if we just, you know, make this or that, we could secure our paradise, or if we just, you know, do a certain thing, we'll achieve this level that will be okay, and we're never going to see that. It's just going to keep going on. You know, further and further and faster is what we're going to see. So the changes, you know, if we were to make them, would be to move back to the things that God has made and rely on them and not so much the things that we make. Because it seems like every time we make something that we think is good, you know, or we introduce a new technology, it really ends up, you know, hindering and hurting us more than it helps us.
All right, thanks so much for the call. I believe we do have Paul Ehrlich with us now on the phone or on a special studio line, author of The Dominant Mind. Thanks, everybody, for all of your calls, because we've had an interesting discussion, and it will prove to be even more interesting as we speak with Professor Ehrlich. Hello, Professor Ehrlich. Thank you so much for being with us. Hello? Oh, I got the
hello.
There we go.
Hello, are we talking?
I'm sorry.
I was told 8:45. I'm sorry.
That's all right. Well, if it's 8:45, you're even early.
Yeah, no, exactly. I left plenty of time. I could have been here earlier.
I'm sorry.
No, no, my fault probably. Yeah. Anyway, the book is The Dominant Animal, and I was hearing somebody discussing the issue of how many people, how you could take all the Earth's people and put them in the Grand Canyon, that sort of thing, which it's perfectly true, but it's also nonsensical. I mean, you know, we could put them on the moon, too. The issue is not how crowded people are, as that is the square footage of the Earth. The question is the resources we need. You put them all in the Grand Canyon, and they're not going to be farming, and they're not going to have anything to eat. So that's just a silly approach. We call that, it's actually called the Netherlands fallacy, because often people will say, well, the population density of the Netherlands is so many people per square mile, and so we can have that over the entire planet. But, of course, the people in the Netherlands don't live on the Netherlands. They get a lot of stuff from elsewhere.
Right, exactly. Let's talk about climate-related changes, because that's very much what we're thinking about right now, and climate-related changes leading to extinction of animals, leading to disease spreading in the world, leading to a lack of food, leading to displacement of people, et cetera. Can you talk about why that may be the issue of the time and what needs to be done about it immediately, Professor Ehrlich?
Well, the things that need to be done immediately are different from the things that need to be done long term. Again, every person you add to the planet adds more, a disproportionate share of greenhouse gases to the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. So over the long term, of course, we've got to get our population stopped from growing and started declining. But at the moment, the only really quick solution, of course, is energy efficiency. That is, we've got to jack up the mileage standards on the cars way up. We've got to stop wars to get more oil to burn when burning oil is one of the things that's killing our environment. We've got to start subsidizing not fossil fuels, but alternate sources of energy so we can transition to a solar hydrogen economy. There's just a whole series of things we should be doing, which at the moment we're not doing any of. So it's a very sad scene, and the scientific community is desperately concerned about it.
Yeah. We had some people call before we were able to connect with you who had made a decision, I think partially based on your book in 68, that they were not going to have children. What do you think of that?
I think it's sad if people want children that they don't have at least one. But I think that patriotic Americans and people in general should absolutely stop at two. If two was where people stopped, then we would have the kind of birth rates that we have now in places like Italy and France and Spain, where there are family sizes are about 1.6 children. And that's where we should keep them until we get Earth's population down to a sustainable size, till we're not destroying the life support systems we all are utterly dependent upon.
And what's that sustainable size?
Well, nobody knows for sure. I think the scientific community, if you go to www.dominantanimal.org, and click on more information, further information, you'll see the statements that the scientific community makes. Everybody knows we have too many people now. The issue of how many we should have when we're sustainable is an issue for the relatively distant future, because at the moment, we seem doomed to go from 6.7 to somewhere in the vicinity of 9 billion people, and that'll be 50 or more years from now. And then we might have 100 years if we tried to bring the population back down to a sustainable number by, of course, the way we want to do it, which is by limiting births, not by increasing deaths, then we'll have 100 years to debate whether we should stop at 5, 4, 3. We'll know a lot more about the system. People will have had more time to decide what kind of life they want to live. Because after all, if we want a battery chicken world with everybody having a minimum of food, a minimum of space, a minimum of options, we might be able to maintain 7 or 8 billion people. If we want to have a world where people have decent lives, it might only be 2. My guess would be about 2, which was about the number of people when I was born. And there were plenty of big cities for people who liked them, and there was plenty of wilderness for people who liked that.
Mm-hmm. Tell me, Professor Ehrlich, about the diminishing resources that we're seeing right now and the conflict that's developing in various parts of the world over those diminishing resources.
Well, it's not mysterious why we have CENTCOM, which is our military establishment aimed at the center of Asia, because, of course, that's where a lot of the oil and a lot of the gas is. Right now, we're seeing that other people are going to be interested in those resources besides us. The Chinese, for example, are running out of petroleum, and they're eyeing the Caspian Sea basin. Now, you may think that we're building gigantic, wonderful jet fighters to fight Al-Qaeda, but that's silly. What our military is being built to do is fight the Chinese and possibly the Russians. Mm. And in a nuclearized war, a world, that's a very, very bad thing. You got to remember in the current standoff about Georgia that the United States and Russia both have thousands of nuclear missiles still on relatively hair trigger alert, pointed at each other. Mm-hmm. And that this is a very dangerous world, and people have got to understand that resources are at the center of it. You know, as Gretchen Daly, one of my colleagues, said when we were talking about going and invading Iraq, she said, "Do you really think that we'd be going to invade Iraq if their major export were broccoli?" We're after the biggest oil reserves in the world, a second biggest oil reserves in the world. Nobody has any doubt about that. Even Greenspan said the war's over oil. So we're killing our kids and killing many, many Iraqis to try and get our hands on a resource we shouldn't be using. It's like It's like the battle to find cyanide, you know, so you can kill yourself.
Mm-hmm. And plus we did this show with Ron Suskind yesterday, who has terrible concerns, as do many people in the country, about all these nuclear weapons, all of these things you can make enriched uranium from. And, you know, they're floating out there. People can get them, they can buy them, and there goes the world.
Well, exactly. We did some recent studies. 25 years ago, we did the nuclear winter studies, which showed if we had a large-scale exchange with the then Soviet Union, it would wreck the world, basically. Mm. And more recent studies show that just India and Pakistan going at it. Suppose a Pakistani bomb gets loose, and instead of using it on us, they use it on Bangalore, for instance. It would ruin the economy of the United States. And it turns out a relatively small nuclear exchange between Russia, India and Pakistan would have climatic effects that would fundamentally destroy the world. We've got to be very careful, and we're not being very careful.
Mm-hmm. Tell me exactly in specifics about the gap in the world between those who have and those who have not. It seems to me as though it's sinful.
Well, something like 3 billion of the world's 6.7 billion people live on $2 a day or less. Hmm. And you can put that in perspective by realizing that the average European cow is subsidized to the tune of $2.50.
Oh, my gosh.
And so, you know, we have horrendous problems of inequity. We became the dominant animal by being absolutely brilliant, and we tell that whole story in the book. But the thing is, we got brilliant technologically so fast that we haven't had a chance for the ethical problems or the ethical side of our culture to catch up. In other words, Plato couldn't possibly have imagined a nuclear weapon or a jet airplane or a computer. But the same ethical problems that worried him still worry ethicists today. How do we treat each other? And, of course, how do we treat our environment? And with the levels of inequity we have and with nuclear weapons, you know, the U.S. and Russia never followed up on their obligations under the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Mm-hmm. And my colleagues for 40 years have been saying if we don't act properly, sooner or later, rogue nations and subnational groups, terrorist groups, will have nuclear weapons. Well, here we are.
Yeah. Tell me how you get it. It seems to me, and you write about this, that you've got a certain percentage of people, our audience among them, most of them, who are vitally concerned about this issue, who are doing what they can to change the world. Then you've got another whole group of people who couldn't give a darn, who aren't thinking about some of these issues that are tied into our very survival. They're going to the mall. They're buying all this stuff. They're using pesticides. They're buying their cashmere sweaters. They're doing all of these things without a deep understanding of what's happening to the world. How do we change that?
Well, what you change that by having NPR take over all the Fox Network and all the others. I mean, the point is people don't know. We're having a presidential election where an issue is whether or not gays can get married when the fate of our entire civilization is at stake. Mm. The news tells you know which starlet is wearing her panties today, which murder went on today, so on and so forth, when the major issues that we face, climate change is getting some attention. But one of the interesting things is there's a lot more to the environment, as we talk about in the book, than just climate change. There is toxification of the planet. We are adding thousands of dangerous chemicals all the time, many of them with no particular benefit, and we're beginning to see very frightening things, like in many subarctic towns, you're getting about twice as many girl babies born as male babies. That says some of the chemicals are doing really nasty things to us, not just to the polar bears. And we are losing the biodiversity, which is the working parts of our life support system, even with climate change. Most people are worried about sea level rise. I can almost promise you that you'll be able to outwalk sea level rise. But we're changing the precipitation patterns all over the planet, and it looks like now they will continue to change, even if we manage to control the greenhouse gases, for another 800 or 1,000 years. And we are utterly dependent on those patterns for our food. And so we are going to have to make huge investments, and we probably will fail to do so, and we probably won't be successful, and many, many people will die because the climate is changing because they won't have enough to eat.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, this isn't being discussed in the and again, go to www.dominantanimal.org and look at what the scientific community says. This isn't mysterious. 58 academies of science gave a huge warning in 1993, the same year the world scientists warning to humanity said that we are crippling our life support systems, and it didn't even make the news. And it included 1,500 of the world's leading scientists and more than half of the living Nobel laureates in science, and it just wasn't even covered in the newspapers.
Hmm. Let's go to phone calls for you. Shelley from Madison, hi.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm so impressed with all the callers that have called in, and I totally agree with every one of them, and especially Dr. Ehrlich. Every point you've said, I could just talk on every one of them and say, I totally agree. I'm 35, and I've also chosen not to have children in my life because even back in high school, I could totally see that there was going to be a problem with population, and I don't want to contribute to that necessarily. I feel like I have an obligation on a higher level to the planet in whatever ways I can contribute to that. And I just have always seen this, and I can totally see what we're headed to, and I feel like we don't have a lot of time left. And I hope that this can get out on a really large level to a lot of people. I'm afraid that the people who are having lots of children, I also agree that we should limit it to two if they really need to have them. I feel it might be some of the less educated people who are having more and more children and aren't able to get the information to understand what a crisis we truly are in. And it's disappointing to see again in the political campaign that this isn't being addressed and we're totally overlooking it. And I feel like we've gotten to a point where we can't be helped because we can't get past the loops in the government. There's too many people who aren't being responsible, who aren't going to take responsibility. They might see this as a problem, but they're just going to go back to their daily life tomorrow because they don't know how to start.
Well, you know, we can do something about that by voting in the right way, because both the Reagan and the Bush administrations have basically been killing women around the planet by putting very severe restrictions on what kind of aid can be given to countries if they offer abortion to women. And of course, as we know, as we've known for decades, if you make abortion illegal, and I'd love to make it rare, just make it almost, you know, never have to occur because we have great contraception. That would be wonderful. But right now we don't have the great contraception. We're limiting our aid in the areas of contraception over the abortion issue. And when you make abortion illegal, all you do is kill women. They don't not have abortions. They just go to quack abortionists. So, and the other thing is, of course, it's particularly in countries like the United States, where each individual is such a huge consumer of the world's resources, not just ours, but, you know, we go over and try and get the Iraqis oil and so on and so forth. It's particularly the rich countries and the rich people who should be limiting their reproduction. And of course, we should give everybody, every sexually active person should have access to full information, the best possible contraception. And in case of mistake, certainly women should have access to safe abortion. It's absolutely nuts for crazy old men to tell young women what they should be doing with their bodies.
Calls, more phone calls in just a moment. Our guest is Professor Paul Ehrlich. His latest book is The Dominant Animal, Human Evolution and the Environment. Our phone number, our lines have been very busy. There are two openings right now, 800-486-8655, or in Milwaukee, 414-227-2050. We also have an email you can use, and that's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 800-486-8655. Dr. Ehrlich, the email for you. Did the population bomb in 68 make any predictions on what the world population would be in 2010?
No, because one of the funny things is we often hear that the population predictions, the population explosion predicted by the Ehrlichs never occurred. Well, of course, when the book was written, there were 3.5 billion people, and now there's almost 6.7. So I don't know whether you want to consider that a population explosion, but since the book was written, many more people have been added to the planet than were alive when Ann and I were born. But we have never made a single population prediction. We have always used the predictions put out by the UN and sort of fine-tuned by the Population Reference Bureau, which is a nonpartisan, excellent organization in Washington, D.C., that produces the data that will tell you. So, and their predictions, the UN and Population Reference Bureau predictions have been very, very accurate. I don't remember the exact numbers, but for instance, I think for right now, they were predicting somewhere in the vicinity of 6.9 and we're at about 6.7. So their numbers, for practical purposes, they've been right on ever since the middle of the last century.
You ask a question in the book, and it's very interesting. I wonder the answer, and it's still in progress, I'm sure. Why some organisms adjust successfully to environmental change while others do not?
Well, the problem today for all organisms is that the environment, global environment, is changing faster than it normally changes. And this puts particular stress on organisms that have long generation times, because evolution doesn't go on in clock time, it goes on in generation time. That is, a bacterium that has a generation every 12 hours, say, can become resistant to an antibiotic in a matter of a couple of days, a population of them. Whereas, of course, that's taking them through hundreds of generations, whereas even one of the reasons that genetic evolution isn't important to human beings very much at the moment in humanity is our generations are 20 years long. So if it would take us, say, 10 generations of 95% mortality to become resistant to DDT, that's 200 years of 95% of everybody being poisoned by DDT before we would become resistant. So generation time is the key, and if the environment is changing fast, then the quicker your generation time, the more likely you are to be able to adjust genetically.
Mm-hmm. Jim from Pleasant Prairie, hi.
Hello. Hi. How I look forward to getting hold of a copy of your book, Dominant Animal. Unfortunately, my local book chain thus far has been unable to get it in.
You can get it from Amazon, but it's terrible because I love to support local bookstores.
Okay. But I'd like to comment that, unfortunately, the body politic and the mainstream media in this election year has done very little, if anything, to get into these issues. The other thing I wanted to bring up is I think it's appropriate at this moment to discuss China, which for this moment is having this very pretty-looking television party, which is the Olympics, and I'm all in favor of that. But the much larger tragedy that is developing there, simply because they have followed a fast-growth model, which includes dependency on auto transportation, which is relatively inefficient, as well as a cheap, dirty energy, and
coal-fired power plants—the last thing in the world we need. Let me do one small bit of I told you so. In 1972, a political scientist, Dennis Paragis, and I wrote an op-ed for the New York Times, which said, "What if all the Chinese had wheels?" And it was raising the issue of what would the world be like if the then 500 million Chinese all wanted cars. And now we have 1.3 billion Chinese, and they all want cars. Mm-hmm. And the sad thing is that China's fractioning into a huge but still relatively small, very rich country with a few hundred million people in it, and a large, desperately poor country, which they may actually end up dividing into two countries, one a coastal, relatively rich country, and one an inland, terribly poor country. But probably none of it's going to work because they're running out of water. They're running out of petroleum. As you can see in the pictures of the Olympics, they're running out of air. There is essentially no potable water in China. One of the reasons they have so much air pollution is that everybody keeps coal fires going to boil water, because you have to basically boil all the water. It's the only place in the poor country in the world that I know where you can drink water handed to you by anybody, because it's all been boiled.
Huh.
And they have huge problems with their agriculture. They've had battles between farmers and troops because the troops are trying to keep water for secondary recovery in their failing oil fields. So China is putting huge pressure on the world's resources, just like we do. They're catching up with and passing us. And the world only has so many resources. And as I indicated before, they're wonderful people. They're very smart. And I hate to think of what will happen if the U.S. and China get into it militarily. It's going to be probably the end of our civilization, which is in great danger anyway. The first time in the history of Homo sapiens, we've had lots of failures and collapses of ancient civilizations. Many of you probably read Jared Diamond's or Tainter's books on this, but they've all been local or regional. For the first time, we have a global civilization teetering on the brink of collapse.
Well, what do we do about that? China's got these problems. We've got these problems. They envy us. They look at the way we've been living and say, hey, that looks pretty good. Cars, you can get around. It's a modern society. We want what you have. We're kind of falling apart because of all of that. They're falling apart because they have these huge numbers of people who want all of that. So what do you do about it?
Well, one thing we could do, since even though the U.S. is now hated around the world thanks to our current administration, we're still looked at in many ways and admired, and we could say, we have made a big mistake that is absolutely nuts for many of our people to drive 2 hours a day to and from work. And
it
we
is
ought
nuts.
To re- yeah, yeah. We ought to redesign our cities around people instead of about automobiles. Automobiles are wonderful. You can take a shared one for a family trip in the summer. They're terrific places for teenagers to make love. But for commuting, they're lousy. You know, if a Martian came down and saw everybody storming back and forth in huge metal boxes to and from work being shot at on smoggy freeways, you know, has anybody's life been made better by this? The answer is essentially no, except some auto and oil and rubber moguls. And we ought to set an example for the world by saying we made a big mistake at the end of the Victorian Industrial Revolution by turning our lives over to automobiles, and we're going to turn it around. And, for instance, make it possible for most people to walk or bike to work or do work. That's where a place where computer technology can help us work at home on a computer.
Mm-hmm. James from Milwaukee is next. Hi, James.
Good morning, Kathleen.
Good morning.
Dr. Ehrlich, you had said that uneven technological development compared to our ethical development is one of the problems. And someone asked Kathleen earlier what could we do. And I want to suggest this. I think our problem is that we've got this moral code that at the center of it is this notion of the time value of money. That basically says that the farther things are away from us in space and time, the less valuable they are. But, of course, we know the exact opposite is true. We know that there are any number of things that are very far from us that have impacts either in the short term, in the long term, et cetera. And I'm just wondering, what do you think about the time value of money as being implicated in the problem of the insensitivity of the few to the many in the world?
Well, I think I think that it's really important. We discount both in time very heavily and in space. That is, one can raise a moral argument that you should be as concerned about a young girl starving in southern Africa as I should be concerned about my granddaughter starving in Washington, D.C. And so that is a really big problem. But an even bigger problem, I think, is the idea that you can only be a successful human society if you're perpetually growing economically. And, you know, if you look at what's happened over the last few decades when our GDP has doubled several times, our quality of life hasn't doubled. You know, when I started at Stanford on a pathetic salary in 1959, the salary is still pathetic, by the way, I could still afford, Ann and I could afford for her to stay home and not work when our daughter was a young girl until she went to school. Every single professional couple I know today, both people are working. Now, has that improved our happiness? The answer is no. When we or the Japanese and so on, when surveys are done, people are no happier today or less happy than they were before a lot of this economic growth, before the GDP doubled several times. So I think one of the things we're trying to work on is to organize a millennium assessment of human behavior where everybody gets together and, among other things, ask the question, what are people for? Are we really just machines to buy more crap? Or, you know, what are the things that, you know, I think some of our artifacts are wonderful. If I had a world, I'd always design it with refrigerators so you could have cold beer. But it's not clear to me that designer refrigerators are critical. It's cooling the beer that's critical.
And there's the next talk show. What are human beings for? I like the title. I'm sorry, we're out of time. Please join us again. You're fabulous. Thanks.
I would be glad to. Thank
Great.
You.
Great. Thank you. The author now of The Dominant Animal, Human Evolution and the Environment, Paul Ehrlich, who has written the book with his wife, Ann Ehrlich, and, of course, wrote The Population Bomb back in 1968. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, to John Treader for on-air production, and thanks for your calls, everybody. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.